This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Please. Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And today's guest is Jeremy Reed, the distinguished poet Jeremy Reed, author and flâneur.
Absolutely. And lovely to be here again. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming in. That was your opening track, Soho Johnny, which I've sort of got the other way around with my theme tune, but that's okay. Because this week we're going to discuss Francis Bacon to some extent, aren't we?
Yes, we are. Aspects of Francis Bacon and Soho, etc.
Yeah, and in fact, you've done a Francis Bacon track as well, which we don't have.
Yes, it's on the new Ginger Light CD called "Excess and Ruin: Meetings with Francis Bacon." I'll read you the poem later.
Excellent. So, but Soho Johnny, when was that done? When did you do?
Ginger Light often perform it live. That came out on a CD maybe 3 years ago, right, called Down For You Is Up, which is still available.
Yeah. And I've managed to retrieve an old cassette, something I actually recorded in the 1980s. I've sort of rummaged through a box, and it's an interview with Francis Bacon, which was obviously done on BBC Radio.
Mm, fantastic.
We can play some bits from that later, as long as it doesn't infringe some horrendous copyright law or something.
I doubt it, no.
You think it's
nope.
All right?
I think Francis always believed in breaking laws, so we're quite all right.
Excellent. And so we're assisted today by engineer Mackie, who might need her assistance with the cassette deck, because just trying to find the right track and getting the volume level right. So Mackie is on standby. So tell me, Jeremy, did you know Francis Bacon personally?
Yes, I did. In fact, when I first came to London, early 80s, due to a friend of mine at the Royal Academy, Francis was actually going to do the book jacket for my first novel, The Lipstick Boys, which I'd written as a student. That sadly, due to his workload, didn't materialise, but I got to know him through that.
He was going to do a book jacket?
Yes.
Wow. That's a staggering piece of news for a start. I had no idea he would have done such a thing.
Well, I think the title, The Lipstick Boys, attracted him.
Yeah.
In the end, the cover was a Keith Vaughan.
Okay.
Saint Sebastian. But so I got to know Francis then, and really the second time I met Francis was in Denman Street, just going into Piccadilly Circus, and he gave me £2,000 in cash, which in the early 80s was quite a lot of money. He said to me, outsider poets, outlaws need help.
Yeah.
So that was a very welcome introduction to Francis. Our friendship extended for maybe a couple of years of meetings, and then he became progressively, I would say, more asthmatic, less.
Uh-huh. When was this, roughly?
This was about 83 to 85.
Yeah. And would he have just had a bundle of notes in his pocket?
Yes, it was all cash.
Yeah.
Everything to do with Francis was always cash. I believe he got $10,000 a week from the Marlborough Gallery, who were defrauding him of huge sums of money, but he insisted on collecting $10,000 every Monday.
Right. Okay.
Most of that went on casino tables, helping the poor in Soho.
Yeah.
And restaurants, I guess, and booze.
Yeah. Wheelers, of course, on Wheelers, Old Compton Street.
And certainly Charlie Chester's Casino, and plenty of alcohol at the Colony, etc.
Yeah, the Colony Club on Dean Street, which is now gone, isn't it?
Now gone with it.
Now closed down.
Former Absinthe Green Walls, yes.
Yeah. So how would you have met him first then? Just encountered him in Soho? Or?
No, I met him initially by going to a little bar that existed in Piccadilly Circus Underground.
Oh, cool.
That probably became a raised around 1990. Yeah. Anyhow, it was a secret little niche that Francis, who didn't appreciate really being recognised, would use to meet people.
Right.
He would bring his own wine in a carrier, because usually a Harrods carrier, because he wouldn't drink the ordinary wine that such a place particularly served.
Right, okay. Was this actually in the Underground?
It was actually in the Piccadilly Circus Concourse.
Okay.
There was a small bar. I think it was called the White Bear, but I may be wrong.
Right. Well, those are the days when you had a bar on the Underground.
Absolutely, yes. We wouldn't get that today. It had been niched there for quite a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
When Piccadilly Concourse was, you know, a warren of little shops, newsstands, and there was a bar there.
Right.
So that's okay. That's where I would meet Francis, yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just for an hour or so to talk, and usually he would leave me an envelope of cash, which helped me greatly.
Right, right. Okay.
He was exceedingly generous.
Yeah, he was known, wasn't he, for being generous to people.
That he liked.
I've been reading this Pepiat book,
yes,
Anatomy of an Enigma,
mm.
and there's all sorts of stories in that where he helped people when they became ill and so on. And he noticed, I think he fell out with his first gallerist, of the Hanover Gallery. I can't remember her name now. And they fell out big time. But then in later life, she became ill. And he apparently donated something like £100,000 for her medical bills, you know.
Yes, that was typical of his altruistic generosity and his love of helping people who he felt deserved it.
Right, right.
I.e. no members of the establishment.
Yeah. So you were a habitué of Soho?
Yes, I always have been since I first came to London.
Yeah.
A Soho that, as you know, becomes increasingly gentrified and less bohemian, but still exists geographically with the aura of those who once belonged there, like Francis Bacon.
Right, right. And of course, you spent many hours in the Patisserie Valerie on Old Compton Street, which is sort of that's gone, hasn't it? But I think the chain is being revived. It's sort of perhaps not quite the way it was, but
yes, I think I probably wrote 30 or more books in that particular Patisserie Valerie on Old Compton Street, and when it was in danger of closing down, I contacted their admin to tell them how famous that was. Yeah. William Burroughs used to write there in the afternoons when he lived in London in the 70s.
Yeah.
Derek Jarman wrote a lot of his screenplays in there.
Right.
David Bowie went in there for coffee breaks when he was recording Ziggy Stardust, etc.
Yeah.
They had no idea of the celebrity, talent
and
greatness of the place,
yeah.
nor around the corner in the fact that the one on Marshall Street, which has recently gone, was sited on Blake's house.
Okay.
Where Blake was born.
Right, right.
The Patisserie Valerie were clueless as to that sort of fantastic historic legacy.
Right, right. In fact, I brought along, just in case we didn't have other things to play, I brought this William S. Burroughs Real English Tea Made Here.
Fantastic.
And there's a sort of story, isn't there, about him. Isn't there some peculiar story where there's a tea room just off Piccadilly Circus, where that Mephisto shoe shop used to be, opposite there. And I think he sort of put a curse on the tea room or something by standing outside looking through the window.
That's right. It was a small coffee bar. From what I've read, Burroughs was a very polite person, and he was offended by their rudeness and by the poor quality of their cheesecake. And so he set about hexing them very successfully. He got them out within about 3 days by using all sorts of methods of cut-up tapes and standing outside the particular premises all day.
Right.
He really did hex them.
Right. Now, shall we? What I'll do is let's play a bit of this cassette tape.
Yes,
then that lets Mackie off the hook, because we can just sort of play this and she can tell me if it's the right volume level and so on. And so I recorded this off the radio in the 1980s, and then when I knew that we were going to do this sort of piece around Francis Bacon,
yes, great.
I just managed to find it and grab it.
Very propitious.
I don't even know who the interviewer was or is, but so
it will be fascinating to hear some.
So Mackie, we bring up this one here, Gram 1, and then if we just start it, and then we'll kind of try and get the volume level right.
Harsher and more macabre. And Christ on the cross is conspicuous by his absence from the painting.
I use the theme of the crucifixion not because I have any religious beliefs whatsoever, but because it was an armature on which I could hang the imagery that I wanted at that time. And these were going to be the images around the base of a crucifixion. I was going to do a whole crucifixion, and then I decided I didn't want to do any more of that.
Did you believe in God at all when you were a child?
Never. Beyond when I was terribly young, of course, I was born in Ireland, and as my father and mother were both Protestant, to, as it were, protest against Catholicism, and we all had to go to church.
And do you remember being at all impressed by Christianity at any stage?
Not at all. It's just so depressing.
When did you lose your faith? Do you remember that?
I lost my faith completely when I was 17.
Do you remember how that came about?
Yes, I do. By some accident, I had begun to read Nietzsche and things like that. And I do remember seeing a lump of dog shit on the pavement. I thought, well, there it is. That's how our life is, unless you make something remarkable of it.
Did that realisation make you angry with Christianity in any way?
Not in the least angry with it. I just felt what a ridiculous harness, as it were, had been put on people.
Well, that's why I asked you about anger, because it struck me that you might well have seen it as a sort of repressive constraint which people really ought to cast off.
No, I didn't feel it. It wasn't anger. It was just a feeling, just even more aware of the nonsense of it.
Bacon's awareness of the absurdity of religion...
So, does that strike a chord with you, Charlie?
Yes, that very, very significant special voice, yes.
Yeah, indeed, isn't it? It is worth mentioning that, isn't it? The sort of very sort of refined...
Refined and very concise. No word is ever wasted with Francis.
Yeah, his ability to compress, hesitation, is there?
No, and his ability to compress language speaks, of course, of his literacy, the fact that he loved reading and that that was complementary to his art in every way.
Right, right. And in fact, that leads on nicely to this. There is, in fact, a show at the Pompidou at the moment,
mm-hmm.
which is about Francis Bacon and his books.
Yes.
Or the books that influenced him the most. And so it's a very fantastic exhibition. And I think it goes on until February. And... basically, in each room, I think he's cited eight books or eight authors, mm-hmm. and they've got the actual book that was Bacon's. So they're often quite well-worn. There's no dust jacket.
Yes.
There's a bit of paint on one of them.
Of course.
And they've got those mounted sort of in a Perspex box or, little box thing on the wall. In a plain grey painted room, each book is in a separate room before... a room full of paintings which sort of relate to each book. And then there's a recording. So as you're looking at this fairly, bland book, I mean, they're not first editions necessarily or anything
no,
like that.
Of course
I think
not.
One is just a paperback.
Yes.
That you can hear someone reading out the text from each
right.
book.
Right.
In French and in English. And we mentioned this earlier, and I think you were able to guess sort of four of the authors off the top of your head.
Yes, of course, the Greek tragedies of Aeschylus.
Yeah.
Eliot's Wasteland, quite obviously. His friend Michel Leiris.
Yeah.
And presumably Genet or Beckett or Joyce.
I think there was Genet and Joyce. There's Proust. There's Bataille. Did you mention Bataille? I can't remember. Nietzsche,
of course.
Nietzsche?
Yes, Nietzsche would fit well with Francis's existential humanistic philosophy.
Yeah.
And certainly Proust with the extraordinary aesthetic beauty. People often forget how beautiful Bacon's paintings are if you take away the visceral content, the colour tonalities, the actual aesthetic of the paintings. I always find extraordinarily beautiful.
Yeah. And I've brought the book along. I think you've had a flick through it. Of course, although he was apparently against nature, as it were.
Yes,
he had very little interest in nature, but
absolutely.
He did go to places. He was in South Africa for a while, where his sisters lived,
yes.
And North Africa.
Mm-hmm.
I think you were mentioned, did you say Morocco?
Yes, I think he used to go regularly to Morocco, largely for boys.
Right.
And presumably, what drink, whatever else, of course, that were his obsessions.
Right. And he would have met Burroughs there, presumably.
Yes, presumably he would have. There's later photographs of the two together when they're both very old and Burroughs came to London. They met then. I don't know if they met in Tangier, quite possibly.
Right.
And, of course, Allen Ginsberg would have been there.
Yeah.
But Bacon, I don't think, mentions either Ginsberg or Burroughs as part of his reading.
Right. But he apparently sort of didn't get on in the countryside at all. But Africa was an inspiration, and there's a sort of connection, I think, with Peter Beard, who does sort of who does these sort of photographs of elephants with, you know, sort of ink or paint splattered on them, which are a little bit Baconian.
I know.
And then, of course, he had a 2-year spell of strangely, well, living in Henley
with
Peter Lacy.
Yes.
And then also this other book, which I've just got, called The Visitor's Book, speaking of dust jackets, because this was in Francis Bacon's shadow, and there were these couple, Richard Chopping and Dennis Worth Miller. And, of course, Richard Chopping was famous for the James Bond dust jackets, wasn't he?
Yes, of course.
And they were friends, and that was in Suffolk or Essex. So,
yes,
so Bacon did have these periods of going out of town.
That's right, yes, yes. Usually for particular purposes.
Monte Carlo, of course.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
But Bacon, yes, we never think of him in any way as pastoral. He is urbanized and, of course, always interiorized. The paintings are almost always within a room or within an enclosed space, a confined space.
So now you one of your books was entitled, which I thought, I was half hoping that you might have it with you, but it's called, was it called The Glamour Poet versus Francis Bacon?
Yes.
Why is it versus?
That was a sort of pop thing. It's a long autobiographical poem about living in London, which is still available from Shearsman Books. No, I didn't bring that today. And also I've written about Francis Bacon in a book of mine called The Dilly, A Secret History of Piccadilly Rent Boys, which is the only book on the subject. There's a chapter called Francis Bacon and the Dark Room, which is the little underground bar we mentioned earlier.
Oh, okay. I must get that.
It gives a particularly graphic portrayal of Francis in that sort of situation.
Right, right. And I think you said you were considering, or you are planning to do, a sort of biography, particularly to do with his
criminal aspects, which are, of course, the most interesting aspects of Bacon.
Yeah.
Apart from his genius, I think he's the greatest 20th century British painter without any comparison.
Right.
But yes, the criminal aspects, the gambling, the mixing with, you know, low life, the visits to the docks when they existed. That whole element, rent boys, that whole element of Bacon, masochism to an extreme level.
But in what sense was he a criminal?
I suppose on his own admission, he was a housebreaker in the 1940s to support himself.
Okay.
He ran illegal gambling rooms, according to him.
Yeah.
And, of course, was very attracted to criminals, generally. There was a connection with the Cray brothers, etc.
Yeah.
So the underside of Francis, yes, is, it's a pity he left no memoir of it.
Who was the one that sort of fell through the roof of his studio? Was that George Dyer or John Edwards? I can't remember.
There is the story, which, again, we don't know whether it's true or not, in which George Dyer broke into Francis Bacon's Rhys Mews, and the condition from Francis was either he provided him with sex or he would call the police. Now, we don't know how true a story that is, but it has been endlessly repeated.
Yeah.
Also, Francis's dealings with the Crays have been much written about, that they essentially blackmailed him and that they would retrieve paintings that he regarded as rejects from the basement of Rhys Mews and then make him buy them back. Otherwise, they would threaten to sell them.
Right, right.
That's, again, a piece of Bacon apocrypha. We don't know whether it's true or not.
Right. I'll try and find another bit of this cassette. Let's see.
Yes, which is fascinating. given the
soul. But the eye at work is still firmly that of a painter rather than a photographer, as Richard Hamilton once discovered when he asked Bacon to take a photograph of him with his Polaroid camera.
When I gave him the camera, and he was quite happy to take a photograph of me, he clearly didn't know which way to point it. He'd never held a camera in his hands before. He'd never taken a photograph, as far as I could see. And so I was rather amused at this figure wavering around in front of me, having to be told, hold it as still as possible. And so he took a photograph and then looked at it. And I also looked at it and was astonished that it was a Francis Bacon. It was wonderfully like the way he would compose a head, the way he would smear it. The whole thing was Francis Bacon. And he said, no, I don't like that. It's moved. And it seemed rather hilarious to me that it should be something which was so perfect, and yet he would deny it. So then he took another one, and he was happier with that because it was more like a photograph that he was accustomed to.
Hamilton's story seems to confirm that Bacon...
So that was the artist Richard Hamilton.
Yes.
Who did... I think he did four little booklets where he asks other artists to photograph him. So there's a whole, you know... I can't remember how many there are in each one, but there's probably, it must be about 100 pictures. I think they were Polaroids. And in this case, it was Bacon who he asked to photograph. And I can remember that one. Hamilton's head does look strangely
Bacon-esque,
sort of smeared or smudged a bit at the edges. And it sounds like it was a complete accident, which, of course, would fit with Bacon's.
Yes, it would fit with Bacon's complete methods.
Yeah. Now, you've brought in, well, do you want to do your Bacon poem yet? Or not? Or you'd rather, should we chat a bit more about the...
I've got a couple of poems about Bacon.
Okay.
I'll read one called Francis Bacon at 73. Slumming it with me, Perrier Jouet. You only die between glasses, he said. Each alcohol metabolites popped vesicle in his irises, red as a planetary shower on Mars. My skin's the canvas now, he said, painting with my naked brain as visceral self-portrait. You could too dig the poem into your skin. Virile colours, not like Freud's skinned Bacon. Outside, Soho drench, pointillistic rain. Bankroll me cash to write, cashmere jumper from Burlington Arcade. Ultramarine, he insisted, not navy as described. His own look, deconstructed, debonair. It's practice. Always look like what you do, he said. Careerists don't, nada, nada. I tried to store each word synaptically. His aura, a mile radius. Rain check on drunkenness into the purple zone. Fell down the stairs last night to know the floor. Throwing eyes at a boy in a white tee. The older you get, closer things come up. Through his glass, in a starburst at the wall, the shatter fizzing like a blonde diamond. So that's a memory of drinking with Francis at 73.
Right.
And some wonderful quotes, which are as close as I can remember to them. Yeah. My skin's the canvas now. Always look like what you do. Careerists don't. Yeah. Fell down the stairs last night to know the floor.
Yeah. So would he have heard these poems? Would you?
No, these are written quite recently.
Okay. Yes. Oh, so they're, I see, retrospective.
Yes,
sort
these
of,
are very retrospectively written, yes. But I kept notebooks of most of my conversations with him.
Right.
When I got home, I would write down what I could remember.
Right. So do you have any recollections of time spent in the French or the colony with him or
French house, but more generalized there, and that he tended to, just by his presence wherever he went, occupy. And of course, he used the Golden Lion next door largely to pick up rough trade or Rent Boys from the Dilly.
The Dilly being Piccadilly.
Piccadilly Circus, yes.
The title of your book.
That's right. Francis spent time, of course, looking for rent. My memories of Francis are more on the concourse at Piccadilly, underground in that little bar, and occasionally at the Colony Club, where again he was the, what should one say, the total focus. Not only by the amount of drink, but by the conversation. He was immensely philosophical in conversation and dug at ideas relentlessly to try and find truths.
Right.
Probably something Michel Pepiat will write about in his two excellent books. And that would tie in, of course, with his love of Nietzsche, etc.
Right.
His desire to find out raw ontology. Why are we here? And of course, he believed in what he used to say, nothing, absolutely nothing.
Right, right.
Other than the marvelous moment in which something special happens, or for him, in which, of course, you're creating.
Yeah. He could be incredibly caustic, couldn't he?
Yes, incredibly rather obscene, cutting. Rude, caustic and cutting to those he didn't like.
Right.
And language was often totally obscene. I believe he would be asked to leave restaurants for it at times. obviously, alcohol was an additive to that.
Yes.
But very, yes, what his beliefs were his total beliefs. And, of course, what I loved of everything about him was so organic. He would never have fitted into the digital age, and that everything was done by hands. Worked and reworked the very texture of his paint, that impasto thick texture, right, of course, to the foundation on his face. Everything was worked organically.
Right.
And same way I write everything by hand, because of the neurological impact from brain to hand.
Yeah. He apparently used to wear rouge and hair dye quite a long, long, long time. I mean, way back in the, probably in the 30s and 40s.
Yes, and lipstick in those years from accounts.
Yeah.
During the time I knew him, he wore light foundation.
Right.
Occasionally you could see a little bit of eye smudge, but largely just light foundation. Max Factor, actually, nothing expensive.
Right, right. And did you say, you were saying he was very meticulous in his appearance. He was very, very much involved.
Yes, the clothes were always beautiful.
Right.
Either beautiful Yves Saint Laurent shirts and suits, cashmere jumpers from the Burlington Arcade to be used on the canvas for texture, as well as worn. Cashmere gave a particular interaction with the pigment. Often very, very, very lovely ties, beautiful greatcoats. Yet he was totally dandified, obsessed with self-appearance, and constantly looking at his reflection. Particularly in any bar mirror or any form of reflection. So that, in a way, like I said in the poem, as he said to me, always look like what you do. He looked unmistakably like Francis Bacon.
Right, right.
You would have recognized him anywhere, buses that he traveled on, whatever.
Right. I'll play another snatch. It's because it's a cassette.
Yes.
I can't always, it's not precisely queued up.
No,
I'm sort of like winding
but it's
forward.
Very interesting, whatever he says.
Yeah, I hope this is, I hope this works this bit.
The horror of wartime and the unease of the post-war period, which triggered the first mature paintings. The public finds it strange. Bacon himself is indignant.
I have never understood why my work has always been thought of as very extreme and brutal.
You find that
perhaps
surprising?
You will tell me what I find it very surprising, yes. I mean, do you think people don't observe life at all? I know that the work that you're doing is not life, it's a concentration of life in another way. But if you think my work is brutal, what do you think about what's going on every hour, what they see every hour on the televisions and everything else?
I think it's that a lot of people, when they see your work, perhaps they wonder why there is this concentration on what they think of as the violent aspect of life.
But I don't think, I think all realism is violent. I wanted to be a realistic painter. And I want to make concentrated images of realism from my point of view, because people always think, why they don't think things that come across to them of the violence that they see on the screen and in photography and all that isn't violent, I don't understand, because it is very, very violent.
So it's not the charge of violence itself that Bacon's objecting to.
I'm cutting out the... You don't recognise the interviewer, do you?
No, I don't. No,
no I don't. I mean, it's from the 80s.
The interview, though, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
And that there is so little of Bacon recorded.
Yeah, there's various... There are some filmed interviews. Well, there's a David Sylvester interviews, of course.
That's right, which are superb.
And then there is a... I think there's one on YouTube, which a Swiss film crew tried to film him, and he became quite a difficult subject. I think
I'm
he was
sure.
sort of like bounding around the studio and so on. In fact, there's a fantastic story in the Pepiat where Cecil Beaton asks him to do a portrait.
Oh, yes.
And apparently he's so horrified by the result. I mean, why, though? Because, I mean, what would you expect, really?
Absolutely.
If you commissioned Francis Bacon to do a portrait,
totally.
You're not going to get a flattering image, are
no,
you?
No, you're not. And of course, I think he paid Bacon to destroy it, didn't he?
Yes. I think he did two. The first one was completely destroyed, and then the second one probably likewise. But he described Bacon as being almost quite athletic.
That's right.
Almost bounding around the canvas and so on whilst looking at...
That's right.
Literally
attacking the canvas and running at it.
Yes. Yeah.
He said that while his doctor complained that he took no exercise, he said he probably ran 4 or 5 miles every morning in the studio.
Right.
Literally physically assaulting the canvas.
Well, he must have had an extraordinary constitution as well for that heavy drinking and staying up throughout the night.
And the physical work of the painting, which was, of course, exhausting.
Yes. Yeah.
And led in later life to, obviously, problems of health.
Yeah.
Total exhaustion.
Well, we'll take a little break here by playing this track that you've brought in. Which I just have to bring it back to life.
You hurt me too.
So, what's the story about this? Why are we playing this?
I particularly love this Elmore James song sung by Mick Jagger in a jamming session.
Right.
It's to me one of Jagger's greatest vocals.
Does it have any relationship to Bacon or Soho?
I think in the sense of You Hurt Me Too, it's part of that world.
Well, whilst this is playing, I can try and line up the next cassette track.
I think this is a masterpiece, this song. Raikudo.
So that was, you particularly wanted to play that track.
Yeah, because it's a very little known track, and it's a jam rehearsal session. I just think that I like Elmore James a lot. I just think Jagger captures that really perfectly.
So the lineup on that was Nicky Hopkins, Ry Cooder, Mick Jagger, Bill Wyman, Charlie Watts.
Yes.
And you play with a band yourself, or can I call it a band?
The Ginger Light. Fantastic, yes. That's Jerry McNee. And occasionally harpist Maria Christina and the Seven Pedals.
Okay.
We have a unique genre of performed spoken word with pre-prepared electric soundscapes, etc. Yes, we're
okay.
We're very active.
Yeah, I should say you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, and today's guest is the poet Jeremy Reed. Do I call you poet or author or all of these things?
You can call me poet. That's my principal.
Poet. It is, isn't
art,
it? That's your
although
principal
I'm a novelist
activity.
And biographer, etc.
Yeah, and we're skirting around Francis Bacon today. Aren't we?
Yes, we are.
And I think you've got another. Do you have another poem? Another Francis
Bacon? I do have another poem. Perhaps to preface that, I can tell you an amusing anecdote, perhaps also a highly masochistic one. In my old publisher, Peter Owen, who was my publisher for maybe 25 years, Peter used to regularly visit Tangier, principally to see Poor Bowles and also for other reasons, and he told me that while he was staying at the Minzer, the police came to see him, and they said, "Sir, there's an Englishman that we find regularly lying in ditches, badly beaten up," which happened to be Francis Bacon.
Right.
And Peter, apparently, according to what he told me, said to the police, "Oh, that is quite normal. Francis pays to be beaten up."
Right. Okay. And of course, his relationship, this Peter Lacey relationship, was a masochistic one, wasn't it?
Yes, a violent one.
Which was sort of 2 years. Apparently, they lived in Henley, and apparently, for a while, Bacon seemed to live in something called the Imperial Hotel Henley, which I suspect isn't there anymore.
I doubt it. It was probably bombed.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, Bacon's interests seemed to have been sexually ones of extreme S&M.
Right.
Involving him being the injured party.
Right, right. All right, shall we hear your next poem?
Yes.
This
is about meeting Francis. Yes, it's called Meetings of Francis Bacon, which the Ginger Light do perform. We don't have it on CD today, but it's on the new Jeremy Reed and the Ginger Light CD called Excess and Ruin. And this is about the little bar I described earlier, Meetings of Francis Bacon. The dark room, Piccadilly Circus underground, the Rentboy subterranean subway bar, ozone whiffy, our recess meeting place, an 80s niche for runaways who found your hands on patronage, those lumps of cash dolloped to street trash. I still see your face peeling foundation, a max factor lick like mine, constructed with a dusting brush, tube wine, the escalators shuffling, click, 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 condensed into the station's ramped up rush above the hammered track. We met in there, you on the concourse trying to turn a trick. The drenching rain outside like streaming pear-shaped diamonds. Your blue shirt like blue pigment you mixed. The shock of us impacting. Like peeling open a hurt from sticking plaster. Random fugitives making the moment pop like a hot jewel caught in the pouring rain. We'd meet and talk on off for 3 years, and the best of it hangs with the worst. Euphoric drunk or dipped into asthmatic burnout, desperate below the drink, you've done it all, and yet everything comes too early or too late. You brought your own wine, black, solid Petrus, uncorked in a Turnbull and Asser carrier into the bar. Your milieu, transient, lawless, underbelly types, one mirror breaking the room up. You talked age, not art. And skinny boys dropped in, viral error, already in their cells. You'd give me wads to write. Poets subvert systems. They'll always think you're fucking alien, he said. And half the world poured out to Regent Street or Piccadilly. Didn't mean a thing. We felt tube traffic vibrate through our feet. You got ill, kept away. The rain today bringing you back. I mean the kindness there for beautiful losers who, losing all, win the experience. I'll stay with them as your uncompromising legacy. You always face forward, back to the wall.
Yes, I have to. We have to. I think, sort of, make some sort of apology for the expletive in there, even though it is in context, of course. But
I was quoting him.
Yes, of course. Yes. That's fine. It's fine with Bacon, me. Yep. But it seems we have to.
Yes, Bacon used.
I'm not sure if it's used in context like that. I don't know if we have to sort of grovel and backpedal like crazy.
No,
but
I think.
But let's do it anyway.
It was a Bacon expletive.
Exactly.
But I apologise for any use of words that are offensive.
That's all right. Thank you. We'll just try the cassette again. We'll see where we are here.
Well, I know what you're talking about. I don't want to have the contact between the images. I want the image to stand there on its own, and if they're one in contact with the other, that will automatically set up a relationship. And therefore, with a relationship, you'll start on a story.
But is it just the fact that you don't like stories in art, or is it something more to do with the fact that you see a human being essentially as a marooned and isolated figure?
I don't see them essentially. One knows. After all, I have done a lot of figures locked together, or however you like to put it.
That's true. But they do tend to be the exceptions rather than the rules, don't they?
No, I can't do them on every single finger. It's probably a limitation on my part, but I don't like discursive painting at all.
Have you always seen yourself essentially as quite a lonely person?
No, I don't think about myself as being especially lonely. But I do like very, very simple imagery, you see. There is another thing about all this. When people talk nowadays about painting, they very, very rarely bring in the effect that photography has had, and the photograph and the cinema and everything has had on painting, and has in many ways cut out the whole illustrational side of painting. You're drawn back more and more to the simple image that doesn't have anything, that's not saying anything, it just stands alone in its own, with its own quality, or its own beauty, or whatever you like to say.
I think you're talking now about what I see in your work as a kind of grandeur. I think that's one of the most positive and indeed exciting aspects of your work, the fact you can attain an extraordinary formal grandeur
in many of your paintings. I can't say I do myself, but I would like to be able to.
But at the same time, you see, I've always thought that this grandeur is accompanied by something very different, and it's to do with loneliness, it's to do with alienation.
But then perhaps grandeur is to do with loneliness.
Is it? Why would you say that?
Well, would you not say that most grand people are alone?
You think it comes with the position?
I think it does, yes. I think it's almost automatic.
And why would that be?
Well, you know perfectly well why. Because they're just, by their very way of thought, their very attitude to things, they are alienated in a sense.
You mean because they've defined themselves as independent people?
Well, you could put it that way if you like, but it certainly gives them, nearly always, people who think clearly and directly and complicatedly about things, are nearly always lonely people.
because they have detached themselves from the way most people think.
Well, you'd need to do that, wouldn't you, to have any quality at all?
So loneliness is seen as a...
Okay.
Quite marvellous.
Yes, yes.
And again, one gets the incredible concision of thought, philosophic insight, and total mastery of what he understands.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think about this aspect of grandeur? Does that sort of...
Well, people often describe Bacon's paintings as highly theatrical,
right?
Because of the colours used by implication, the camp integrated into the work at times.
Right.
But yes, he is right. I think if you live in your own inner space, of course, you're going to be lonely, alienated, and people will consider you perhaps to have a grandeur that doesn't, or that they may resent because it doesn't seem to fit with popular tastes.
Right, right.
So Bacon, as I say, just by his presence was defined as different.
Yeah. Do you think that milieu that you describe, the Piccadilly milieu and the Soho milieu, is it sort of made up of isolated individuals who came together because they had that in common?
Yes, I think it certainly was. That's very well expressed. I think it certainly was during the period I knew Bacon, and in periods that you've known Soho, where it was largely the prerogative of the creative, the isolated, the alienated, to get together there and form some form of community, whereby isolation was dissolved in the process.
That's quite a strange paradox, isn't it? Isolated individuals actually trying to find each other.
Places like Patisserie Valley were where you found those people.
Yes.
In order to share perhaps aspects of your alienation.
But how does that work? I mean, do the people come together happily, or is there still a highly competitive element amongst them?
I think highly competitive, and in Bacon's case, of course, very competitive,
right,
as we can hear from that interview. Yep. Bacon never tolerated fools. He was far, far too intelligent.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's, again, an underrated aspect of Bacon's painting, how intelligent the sensibility that he brought to it was in terms of reading, in terms of being able to analyse people's psychology.
Yeah, yeah. When did you last see him, do you remember?
Probably not after 1986. He died, what, 93, was it?
I'm not sure. I can't remember without looking up.
I didn't see him in the last 5 years of his life, no.
No, okay.
Our meetings covered a condensed period of about 3 years.
Yeah.
I mean, they weren't continuous. They would be, you know, occasional.
Yeah. And did you know his associates? Would you have known people like John Deakin? And
Always met one-to-one.
Oh, really?
Yes,
was
distinct from
Bacon. By arrangement or just by
chance?
Yes,
by arrangement. We always agreed to meet one-to-one.
Right.
Our meetings usually didn't exceed maybe an hour, hour and a half, something like that. But in that time, you learn more than perhaps you would in 5,000 hours of other company,
drunk
or not.
Right.
Simply because Bacon's mind, even drunk, was able to laser through a person in a way that was extraordinary.
Right, right. Yes, so you describe him as charismatic, presumably.
Hugely charismatic, right. Yes. Yeah. Yes, he would occupy a space that was unimpeachable and uninfringable. He was that space.
Right, right.
And of course, highly magnetic from his unusual looks and the clothes, and of course, the extraordinary views.
Yeah.
Maybe the obscenity at times, the drunkenness, but always that composite ability to focus on people and situations in a way that's not common.
Right. Would you like to read another poem, because we've got a few minutes left, and I'll try and find another snatch of Bacon on this cassette, which is a bit tricky, but I'll see what I can find. But perhaps you could read a poem in the meantime.
Yes, I will read a poem.
Which
I rather like, called Store Thieves. Francis knew a lot of store thieves. Tricky finger poetry, like touching something on the dash you didn't see. Wonky geometrics, slippery as gelatine, in lending objects, microgravity, displacement from A to B with asymmetric dexterity. She couldn't put that together mid-store. Foggy with paracetamol, blue oversized Disney eyes, face-spotting prospective customers, moon walking by. She never saw the object go. So fast it seemed autonomous, a time-slip trickster's telepathic lift, hot as a Boeing's orange exhaust glow. She doesn't know re-sewn interiors or stratospheric dopamine rush, sightings that see round corners, eyes that fingerprint their target, brown or grey in trancy, communal, Selfridge's crush. Her headache gets a silver dazzle rinse, the way things disappear. Compacted fit she can't work out, and done right in her face. Left hand, right hand, the movement occupies peculiar mass across the shortest space.
Excellent. So that's from your, which
that's from a collection called Candy for Cannibals, published by Ennis Arman Press.
Right. And is that a recent
That's a recent
anthology?
Book, yes.
Or
a recent book of poetry.
It's not an anthology.
No,
is it?
It's a recent new book of poetry, yep. Candy for Cannibals.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Jeremy Reed, for coming
thank
in.
Thank you very
and,
much.
And hope you can perhaps come back in the new year.
I would be delighted. I always love to come here.
Fast approaching. We can end with another little snatch of Bacon talking about Aeschylus. This might just be a few seconds, the way the time is hurtling on. We've got 1 minute, I think, of some Bacon. So thank you again for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Outlet. The whole notion of catharsis may help to account for Bacon's long-standing preoccupation with ancient Greek tragedy. He reads it as voraciously today as he did when young, and Aeschylus is a particular favourite, presumably because Bacon prefers his rough and intensely physical metaphors to the smoother classical perfection of Sophocles and Euripides. He once referred to his wartime triptych of three figures at the base of the crucifixion as the Greek Furies, and almost 40 years after that first triptych was completed, he painted another, far larger one, called Triptych After the Oresteia of Aeschylus, filled with dark intimations of sacrificial ritual. Whatever interpretations we might be tempted to make of such a work on a subconscious...
Well, such is the nature of cassettes, I couldn't find Bacon's voice, but anyway, that was about Bacon, so thank you very much for listening.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.